But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks for the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. This morning, we're starting a new sermon series called One Verse. Each Sunday, who's ever preaching will be preaching essentially on one verse. That verse will be a significant verse for the individual preaching. It might be a verse that has played an important part in their story, in their relationship with Jesus. It might be a verse that answers the question for them, why do you live the way that you live? And the verse that we're starting out with this morning is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. It's the verse that I just got through saying. It says this, in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks for you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. When people see this verse, there's a tendency among some to get fixated on one part of the verse. And the part of the verse that some people get fixated on is always be prepared to give an answer. Now, in unpacking this verse, it's not the place that I would normally start. But for this morning, why not? Well, we'll start there. Always be prepared to give an answer. Now, if you were to go talk to people about why they might hesitate to share their faith, to talk about Jesus with people outside the church, with non-Christians, many people would say, I'm afraid to talk about my faith because I'm afraid I won't know what to say. I'm afraid to talk about Jesus things with people outside the church because what if they ask me a question that I don't have an answer to? And that fear can be paralyzing for people. And so they don't share their faith at all because they don't know how to give an answer. And so for those people, what the church will often do is point them in the direction of apologetics. If you're not familiar with what apologetics is, it's not apologizing. It's not going, I'm sorry for Jesus. And that's not what it is. Apologetics is the discipline of being able to articulate or to make a reasoned argument or a defense of the gospel, of the person and work of Jesus Christ. That's what apologetics is. And so when people are afraid, they go, I don't know what to say, the church will often go, what you need is apologetics. And there are tons of wonderful resources in the world of apologetics. There are books. One of the best sellers was a book probably a decade or so ago, A Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. There's a student version of it too that's fantastic. There's the classic More Than a Carpenter by Josh McDowell. There are conferences. Bayside, in our own backyard, in October, had a two-day conference on apologetics. They'll probably have it again. There are websites, there are videos, there are multiple resources to help the individual become equipped in the discipline of apologetics to be able to give an answer. So here's the thing. Is there a time and a place for apologetics? Yes. Yes, 1,000 times yes. Is it important for us to be able to articulate the faith? Absolutely. There was a book that came out probably 30 years ago on apologetics. It was called Don't Check Your Brain at the Door. In other words, God gave you a brain. You should be using it. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. I was working with a team of church leaders once, and I was talking to them, kind of guiding them through this process, and I said, what books are you currently reading? And it was nothing but blank stares. And I go, work to be done. If you are not taking time to sharpen yourself here, how prepared are you going to be to give an answer? If I were to ask you right now, what are you reading? Do you have an answer? And are you only reading things that you already agree with? If you're reading only the things that you already agree with, I wonder how much sharpening you're doing. When it comes to apologetics, though, one of the mistakes the church often makes is we get ourselves really worked up to answer questions that the world isn't actually asking. We'll spend a bunch of time coming up with these defenses of the faith when those might not even be the questions that the world around you is asking. There's a great clip from the movie Field of Dreams that illustrates what happens when we answer questions that aren't actually being asked. Take a look and a listen.
I was the East Coast distributor of Involved. I ate it, drank it, breathed it. Then they killed Martin, killed Bobby. They elected Tricky Dick twice. Now people like you think I must be miserable because I'm not involved anymore, but I got news for you. I spent all my misery years ago. I got no more pain left for any of you. I gave it the office.
So what do you want?
I want them to stop looking to me for answers, begging me to speak again, write again, be a leader. I want them to start thinking for themselves, and I want my privacy. Dog and a beer.
$2.
What do you want? I want people to start thinking for themselves. I want people. No. What do you want to eat? Someone comes up and says, What is the best way? Jesus is the way. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. He said so himself, and no one gets to the Father but through him. But no buts about it. And this is classic logic here, my friend. Jesus is either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord. I don't think you understand. Oh, but I do understand that the beginning of wisdom starts with the fear of the Lord. No, I want to know how to get to Folsom Lake. Oh. Take Douglas and watch the signs. How often do we get ourselves all geared up to answer questions the world isn't actually asking? It's important in this verse because, like I said, when people see this verse, they get fixated sometimes on always be prepared to give an answer. And don't get me wrong, there is a place to become disciplined in apologetics. But pay attention to what this verse is actually saying. Always be prepared to give an answer, but for what? Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. We're supposed to be able to give a reason for the hope that we have. In other words, long before we ever give an answer, we need to be living a life worth being asked about. Long before we ever give an answer, we need to live a life worth being asked about. In the words of Michael Frost, and I've always loved this, live questionable lives. Live questionable lives. I love the little turn of a phrase there. In other words, live a life worth being asked about. Live a life that makes somebody go, I gotta ask. What's your deal? There's an old communication theory that goes something like this. And I'm actually going to turn to this guy right here. There you go. I had to look at my notes. There's an old communication theory that goes something like this. When predictability is high, impact is low. In other words, if your audience is expecting you to say X, Y, and Z, and then you go and say X, Y, and Z, the impact, not very large. But if the world or your audience is expecting you to say X, Y, and Z, and you say baboon, oh, they're going to lean in a little bit. When predictability is high, impact is low. When you do it a little differently, people pay attention. For instance, on the first Sunday of every month, we take communion. This morning, I stood on a chair in the middle of the room. Chances are you noticed. Chances are in that moment, you leaned in a little bit. Wait, what's going on? Why is Mike standing on a chair in the middle of the sanctuary? Predictability is high, impact is low. But when we live a little different, when we do something a little unpredictable, people tend to pay attention. Frost seized on this idea and went a little bit longer, and he said, when an audience is surprised or intrigued, they will think long and hard about what they've heard. The same goes for Christian outreach. This won't be a matter of simply doing somewhat surprising but occasional things. I believe we need to develop a new set of rhythms or habits that foster a missional lifestyle that intrigues others. In other words, our culture expects Christians to behave a certain way. And when we behave that way, positively or negatively, and I would argue that with the negative, we should probably stop the negative things. With the positive, keep doing those, but let's be honest, they're probably not going to capture the imagination of a non-Christian world. We might need to change some of our habits so that the predictability level has just gone down and a watching world goes, what are those crazy people doing? And why are they doing it that way? It's why we've talked so much about BELLS over the last couple of months around here. The acronym BELLS. Bless three people a week. Might be encouraging them. Might be helping. Might be a letter. Who knows? Bless three people every week. If there's one of those three people is a non-Christian that you're blessing all the time, I guarantee they're going to go, what is up with this person? And why do they love me so much? Bless three people every week. Eat with two people every week. Practice hospitality. Listen to the Spirit. Develop a habit of listening to the Holy Spirit. Learn Christ, not simply learn about Christ. Learn Christ and remember that we are sent. If we live this way, we become increasingly unpredictable in a world that assumes Christians behave a certain way. And that goes for inside the church as well as outside the church. Frost gives us two questions to consider when we think about living a somewhat unpredictable life in the eyes of the world. Reflect on the rhythms of your life. Which of them are motivated primarily by your faith? And by the way, if you actually do a good inventory here, it can get a little disturbing because if we're being honest here, if you look at the rhythms of our life, we'll be shocked that so many of our rhythms have nothing to do with our faith at all. We'll get to that in a moment. Reflect on the rhythms of your life, which of them are motivated primarily by your faith. But here's the follow-up question with it. Of those, which do you think would qualify as questionable? Practices that non-Christians in your life would find surprising or intriguing. What are the practices in your life that would cause the non-Christians in your life to go, I have a question. If you're living into their assumptions already, they're probably not going to ask a question. It's like, oh yeah, predictability, zero impact. If you start living in a different kind of way, people are going to ask you questions. But what does it look like? We mentioned BELLS, but what does it look like to live a life that is very questionable, that is countercultural? And when I say countercultural, hear me now. I'm referring to countercultural, not just countercultural in the world, countercultural in the church too. Because let's be honest, oftentimes the faith of the church has become highly predictable and very domesticated. what would it look like? What would it take for us to have a life that is countercultural and with this bizarre amount of hope? Always be prepared to give an answer for anyone who asks for that crazy, weird, countercultural hope that you have. Well, to answer that, you go to the beginning of the verse. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. This is where it's got to start. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Here's the problem here. This idea of Jesus as Lord, it's become pretty tame. I mean, we sing it, we say it. I still remember one of the first worship choruses I learned in my church down in Richmond. He is Lord, he is Lord, he has risen from the dead and he is Lord. Every knee shall bow, every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is. Oh yeah, it was just this great song that we'd sing. It was one of the first worship choruses I learned as a kid. Jesus is Lord. We're so familiar with it, we've lost sight of the historical reality of that phrase. Because that phrase, Jesus is Lord, is radical. In fact, it goes all the way to being treasonous. Because to say Jesus is Lord is to say Caesar is not. To say Jesus is Lord is to say Caesar is not. In the first century, at the time of Jesus, at the time of the early church, a common, if not required, phrase of any good citizen, Caesar is Lord. Caesar is Lord. The Jesus followers go, no. All due respect, no. Caesar is not Lord. Jesus is Lord. To say that got you in trouble. Is it any wonder that so many Christians were killed by the Roman government? The Roman government was pretty ticked off that this group, this cultish group of Jesus people said, you know what? Your government, your way of thinking, your conclusions, yeah, they're incorrect. They're substandard at best. I appreciate some things about the Roman government. We've got great roads. We really do. We have access to so much. The Pax Romana, really amazing. I'm living in a time where, there's brutality in the world, but my little world's doing pretty well. I'm very appreciative of some of the things that the Roman government provides me, but Caesar is not Lord. One person that I was reading this past week put it this way: who is Lord? When the apostles and the believers in the pages of the New Testament answered that Christ is Lord and Caesar is not, ramifications followed. That decision had consequences. If Jesus is Lord, it should impact everything. In fact, when we submit to the lordship of Christ, our lives become increasingly questionable. When we submit to the lordship of Christ, our lives become increasingly questionable, both in the non-church world and in the church world. When we submit to the lordship of Christ, it should impact everything, and as a result, our lives become increasingly questionable. Our lives get weird. Our lives get countercultural. I remember I got really fired up one time, and I'm ashamed to say I've done nothing about it. But I remember I'm studying the book of Acts in seminary. I'm studying the book of Acts, and the people of God had everything in common, and they shared and everything. And I remember studying and go, why does everybody on my street own a lawnmower? That was my thought. So I'm sitting here in my seminary class wondering why everybody on my street owns a lawnmower. I know you're thinking that my cheese is completely falling off my cracker, but stay with me. I go, wait a second. The church, the people of God, shared. They shared. And I go, okay, so let's say every lawnmower on the street – Let's say they all cost $100. I'm just doing mic math here. I got to have round figures here. If every house on the street has a lawnmower and every one of us is paying $100 for our lawnmower, I go, what if the first three houses on either side of my street, if we didn't all own lawnmowers, that's $600, what if we just got one lawnmower to share with all six of us? But we got a good one because it's going to be used more. So we spent $300 on a really good lawnmower because it's going to be shared. That would mean there's $300 more. At the time, a compassion kid cost $25 a month. You know how long we could take care of a kid in Zimbabwe if we just shared our lawnmowers? Of course, if I went to my neighbors and said, hey, there's a kid in Zimbabwe I think we should all be helping. Let's sell all of our lawnmowers and just get one. They would look at me like I was nuts. If I went to our church and said, hey, everyone, everybody owning a lawnmower by themselves is sin, that'd be a stretch, but you would look at me and go, Mike, you've gone too far. The wear and tear, Mike, you got to consider that. I don't like my neighbors. But you know what? Living the way of Jesus is weird. Living the way of Jesus is countercultural. Living the way of Jesus should look very different. It should impact every part of our lives, including our lawnmowers. Because Jesus is Lord, my life and how I live it is impacted. For instance, because Jesus is Lord, I tithe. I give 10% back to the church, and then we give in addition to that. Why? Because Jesus is Lord, and that's how he's told me to live. I'm supposed to live a life of obedience and generosity when it comes to my resources. Jesus is Lord. And so that happens. Because Jesus is Lord, my conclusions and convictions about matters of immigration, refugees, economics, sexuality, and poverty are reached by the words and example of Jesus and not by popular culture, news media, or political parties, which puts me at odds with just about everyone. Because Jesus is Lord, I spend a ridiculous amount of my, quote, free time at a gym at Rockland High School. Why? Because Jesus says, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And my Jerusalem is Rockland High School. That's my Jerusalem. That he's called me to go be an ambassador for the name of his son, Jesus. I get to be an ambassador there. And I am going to go and proclaim the good news of Jesus in the way that I interact with players and coaches and parents and school administrators. I do this because Jesus is Lord. I had somebody go, Mike, shouldn't you be spending more time at church? And I go, no, I should be spending more time being the church. Church culture says, oh, no, button down the hatches, take care of yourself. Oh, but the way of Jesus when he's Lord looks radically different than that. And you, Peter, I'm going to establish my church on you, and the gates of hell will not prevail against you. We think, oh, we got the gates of hell. They're coming after us. Have you ever seen gates move? Gates are stationary, which means we're called to go at the gates, to leave here, to go there, and just beat the stink out of the gates of hell, because guess what? Our God's really big, and we've been called to go. But when we talk that way, some people don't like it. But because Jesus is Lord, I'm compelled to live differently. What does it mean that Jesus is Lord? I love the way that Madeline Arthington puts this. She puts it this way. What Jesus is Lord means, it means cost. To say Jesus is Lord costs. It means that you go, oh, wait a second, this is going to cost me something. And what it costs me is top billing. Jesus is Lord. I'm not. There can only be one. There is a God and I ain't it. In the drama of life, there's only one star and it's Jesus, which makes me a supporting role at best. It costs me my preferences. It costs me my comfort. It means that it's going to cost me because he goes, you need to pick up your cross and follow me, quackity quack. What is it? What does Jesus is Lord mean? It means costs. It means allegiance. I loved how she put this. She says, proclaiming Jesus as Lord is to pledge loyalty to him when other people or circumstances coax us to leave. The deceitful hope of something better can tempt us to replace Jesus as our first allegiance. Where is your primary allegiance? It means cost. It means allegiance. It means submission. We see this in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus is, it's the night before he's going to be murdered. And he's in a conversation with the Father, and he says, God, if there's any other way, if there's any other way that the reconciliation of humankind can be done apart from what I know is coming, I'm all for that. My preference would be. But at the end, what does he say? Thy will, not my will. Your way, not my way. He submits. To say Jesus is Lord means that we live a life of submission. Faithfulness in Christ's lordship also means letting Jesus call the shots because we believe he knows best, even when we don't understand. I will submit to the way of God, the way of Jesus, even when it doesn't make sense to me, even when it's confusing to me, even when I don't like it, lawnmowers. Because I believe that he knows best, and I will submit to him because of that. Jesus is Lord. And finally, Jesus is Lord means joy. This is really, really good news, people. To say Jesus is Lord isn't, oh, man. Jesus is Lord. Dag nabbit, Jesus is Lord. I'm going to hate this. Oh, Jesus is Lord. This is going to be so brutal. Oh, Jesus is Lord. No! Jesus is Lord is really good news. Really good news. And if you don't see it as good news, you don't get it. Jesus is Lord. Beyond the fact that he was born as a baby, went to a cross, suffered and died, was dead and buried, was raised again, meaning that I have the opportunity to have all of my sin forgiven, have my relationship with him restored, and I can live with him forever. And regardless of what happens to this body, I know that I'm going to be resurrected with him. Beyond that, which if that was it, that's really good news and enough cause for joy. But there's more to it. I get to live a life that has greater purpose, has more reason for passion, has more reason for hope than any other option the world has. That's really good news. Jesus is Lord is cause for celebration. It's going to be hard. Anyone that tells you otherwise is lying. Just ask those people in the first century that said Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not. Oh, just think of how it's going to be responded when you look at your friend and you say, because Jesus is Lord, I am not wholeheartedly in support of the Republicans or the Democrats. Oh, you're going to have some people lose their minds over that one. Jesus is Lord. Caesar is not. It's going to be hard, but my goodness, it is so much better. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Oh, that looks radically different. When we daily choose to live a life where Jesus is Lord, not our politics, not our cultural norms, not our church cultural norms, not our comfort, not our preferences, when Jesus is Lord, our lives become tremendously questionable. The people in our lives will begin to ask questions. What are you doing? Why are you doing that? In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer for anyone who asks for the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. You've heard me say this before. My free translation of this is, we're never given permission to be part of the Jerks for Jesus Club. Somewhere we've made it this cultural thing where if you're right, you have permission to be a jerk. Have you ever had somebody go, but I'm right? Yeah, but you're not nice. Do it with gentleness and respect. Then people go, wait, Mike, Jesus was hard on people. True. Pay attention to who he was hard on. The religious folks, he took to task. The people on the fringes, he spoke truth uncompromisingly, but with a different tone in his voice. I heard it put this way once. Jesus would comfort the afflicted, and he would afflict the comfortable. As we interact with a hopefully questioning world, we get to do it with gentleness and respect because we're following the example of Jesus. But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer for anyone who asks for the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. If you were to ask me, Mike, what is one of the most important verses in your life, I'd point to this one. Because this is how I want to live my life. Some days I'm not very good at it. And I'm sorry because some days when I haven't been good at it, it's been at your expense. I apologize for that. But this is how I try to live my life. I want to daily set apart Christ as Lord over an increasingly larger percentage of my life. And I'm going to be prepared, which is why I read so many books and go to so many conferences and watch so many videos. I want to be prepared to give a good answer when people ask me, Mike, why are you so weird? And I want to do it with gentleness and respect. You've heard me tell this story multiple times. My oldest daughter was in eighth grade. I was helping coach her softball team. We're driving out to softball practice. As we're driving along, my daughter looks at me and goes, Dad, why are you helping coach on this team? And immediately I knew why she's asking the question. Because the head coach of this particular team was not a very nice person. My wife's down here going, He was a difficult person. Dad, why are you helping coach on this team? Why are you putting up with this? And I said, well, there's two reasons. One, I get to spend a bunch of time with you. And you're a great kid. And we get to drive to practice together. We get to drive to games together. We get to spend time together. And I love you. The other reason is I believe that God has put our family on this team for this particular season of life because we have the opportunity to change the perception. And she looked at me and she goes, what do you mean change the perception? And I said, well, here's the thing. The world has a certain perception of what Christians are. They have concluded that we are judgmental, hypocritical, more driven by our politics than we are by Jesus, anti this and anti that. But we get a chance to live in a different way. We have a chance with this team to live lives of such generosity and encouragement and grace and compassion that when they find out we're Jesus followers, their brains are gonna melt because they don't have a category for us. Because we're living a very questionable, I didn't say this at that time, very questionable way of life. We get to help change the perception of what it means to follow Jesus, what Jesus is all about. She just goes, huh, that makes sense. What's my one verse? In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer. For anyone that asks for the reason for the hope that you have, do this though, with gentleness and respect. Would you pray?